ready for a war!
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Let me see your war face. Ah! That's the war face.
How about global thermonuclear war?
You don't scare me. Work on
it. All right, here we go. We're into the 9 o'clock hour on this Friday. Only less than 60 minutes to go. And one of our great favorite guests, Nichols College Economics Chair, is joining us. And, you know, Hans Despin has been a great addition to the show, an asset for sure. And we appreciate him carving out time to join us. And, you know, he came to our birthday party. That was a lot of fun. We threw him up on stage and I thought we had some laughs and some fun. But we always appreciate him coming on. And, you know, Hans, I wanted to talk to you today because I saw this. I thought it was just a fascinating sort of short clip, video clip, where an economist was explaining like how much an actual young person today needs to make and have in order to buy a very average house. And essentially it was you have to make about $110,000 a year, no debt, zero debt. And at that point in time, if you have that going for you, and a clean, you know, the clean credit history, you probably can buy an average home in America right now, which I thought was absurd. How is somebody making $35,000-$40,000 ever gonna own a house, Hans?
Yeah, hi, Lee. Nice to talk to you. And your party was great.
Oh, thanks. We had fun. We're glad you're there.
Way back several months ago, but. Yeah, young people, you know, really, I mean, one, you know, the demand of homes went down as prices began to rise a little bit because of the increase in interest rates. But more significantly, the supply of homes on the market went down because the interest rates are high, whereby people, you know, like ourselves, who have very low interest rates, we may want to sell our homes, but when we see that the home we can buy to replace it is a whole lot less because of the increase in interest rate, we take it off the market. So there's a lack of supply of homes on the market, and that pushes up the price. That really hurts. But then you look at the interest rate for young people, and it just increases the price of the home astronomically. So again, this is, you know, kind of Worcester data that I've analyzed, but it's very characteristic through across the country, you know, just to be a little bit different numbers. But the median price of a home about 10 years ago was about $230. Today, that's, you know, more like $350 for the median. And the interest rates have gone up from about 3% to about 6% for, you know, not perfect, but, you know, good credit. And what that means is the monthly mortgage has gone from $1,200 to $2,400 a month. It's nearly doubled. And you're paying in 30-year time period almost $1 million more for that home, most of it all going, that increase is primarily a $100,000 increase in the price of the home. But the rest of that million is the interest to the bank over 30 years. So that's just prohibited young people from being able to buy, unless, as you point out, they're making 110, which usually means you have to have a partner, which, again, a lot of young people don't. And so it's become astronomically more difficult for young people to buy a home, to buy a car, so on and so forth.
All right. That being said, even with that being said, it seems like, maybe it's my imagination, you're in the real estate market, it does seem like a lot of apartments and apartment sort of complexes are being built. Am I wrong about that, or am I right about that?
I don't think so. No, let me just say, I haven't looked specifically at the rate of which things are being built for rental.
Right.
I'm sure it's going up because the price of rentals is just astronomical. You know, and, you know, I have a 4,000 foot home, and our mortgage is, you know, about $1,600, $1,700 a month. My wife and I have multifamily homes, our two bedrooms that are, we have 800 square feet, two bedrooms, and we have 1,200 square foot, two bedrooms. We're getting respectfully 1,200 and 1,400. It blows me away that we're getting rent for one apartment in a three or four family home that is almost identical to our 4,000 foot home.
Wow.
A single resident.
Yeah.
I can't even believe it.
Right.
I don't know how people are affording. And in you know, one case, in one of the 800 foot square two bedrooms, there's two families. You know, there's two couples each with a child, six people in this home, and you know, very nice people, but I just they're struggling, and this is, you know, pretty typical. So, of course, that encourages people to, you know, open up a residential rental.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to make your mortgage, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. economic
really
change.
Really amazing.
Yeah, it is crazy. And again, this is what people are fighting against. And I want to, that takes me sort of to part two of our conversation, which is corporate profits / you know, the disappearance of the middle class. And, you know, we've talked about this before in the past. My question to you is, you know, you've got to have an idea of a solution, right? I mean, we see this widening gap between the ultra rich. It can't be as simple as taxing the corporations, because if they make a product, they're gonna make the product more expensive. So, what is it? What's the solution? You've thought about this. You're a smart guy. You're smarter than most of us. You know, what kind of a solution have you come up with to fix what's happening here?
Well, let me elaborate on the problem just a little bit. In 1997, corporate profits before tax were $836 billion annualized. 2023, the most recent data annualized for the fourth quarter, is $3.6 trillion before taxes. Okay, so $800 billion to now $3.6 trillion. And if you look at this data, Lee, you see it's like a stair step. So corporate profits are, you know, kind of hovering at the same level, and then they take off from 1980s into 1997. That's the first. And then, you know, kind of flats out, and then it takes off again in 2006. And that's where it goes well over, you know, almost $2 trillion before taxes. And then takes off again in 2019 to $2.3 trillion. But from 2019, so $2.3 trillion to 2023, just 4 years, they go from $2.3 to $3.6 trillion. So, you know, now when you start thinking about why did this happen, it happens for three reasons. One, tax cuts, and you can attribute that primarily to Republicans, George Bush and then Donald Trump, that gave some pretty generous tax cuts to corporations. But you also have to include the deregulation that went on, which was really more the Democrats in Bill Clinton in the 1990s with big banks, and then Obama trying to get the recession going, really kind of deregulates things, which just allows corporations to keep more and more money. And then the third thing, that takeoff from 2019 to 2023 is COVID. And what happens, Lee, is that small business gets decimated and corporations, you know, are able to concentrate. It's not just corporations, but the bigger businesses are able to concentrate. The bigger you are, the more advantageous it is that small businesses are going bankrupt. And our paycheck protection program, that was the response to COVID for small business, was really a poorly designed piece of that legislation. The rest of the COVID response was pretty good for the most part, but for small business, it was just horrible. Unless you were already in pretty good shape, and so that's what happened there. So, you know, and I'll touch into what's happened to the middle class, as you just suggested, because what ends up happening, so we still have a middle class, but it's shrinking. It used to be about 8% of American population. So if you go back to 1971, 8% of the American population were wealthy, which I am defining as 150% above median income. So you're looking at, you know, about 190,000 household income is what I'm defining as wealthy. That's increased from 8% of the population to now 14%. But on the other end, it's been more dramatic. The number of poor people have increased from 25% in 1971 to 43%, which I'm defining as double the poverty rate. So the poverty rate being about $28,000 for a family of four. If you double that, it's $56,000 for a family of four. I'm defining that as poverty on the basis of you qualify for government assistance. So most of those people, you know, 95% of folks in that demographic are on public assistance. It's the poor have increased, the wealthy have increased, and then what's gotten squeezed is the middle. So it's gone from about 67% of the population to 42% of the population. I'll take a breath.
Right. Okay, so... I don't want to run out of time today without getting some kind of a solution from you. I know we have talked in the past about universal basic income. Is that a solution for this?
Okay, so thank you. The solution is what we need to recognize is, you know, sort of two things have happened that just failed to protect the incomes of especially. Non-manager types. So that's an interesting phenomenon in and of itself. So that's a legal, you know, that's a legal issue. We would have to have legal, laws in place that would protect wages and rights of workers and that sort of thing. Work has become much more precarious. You know, at a college, you just mentioned internships. Right, people cringe, and an internship is just a suspension of labor laws. That's all it is. It just says if you're called an intern, the business does not have to follow the ordinary labor laws. We suspend them and loosen them, and we also have temporary workers and so on and so forth. In higher education, we have professors, and we've seen adjunct professors, and that is a type of temporary worker that goes from anywhere from 80,000 to 150,000 as a regular professor. Now you might be paid, $2,000 to $5,000 a course, so that you're only making, $30,000 to $50,000, $60,000 a year. So significantly lower pay, and we're seeing that. That's just one example, but we see that across industries, and so workers are just in more precarious. So I would start with. We need to take a look at the legal environment for American workers and decide what we could do there to keep salaries higher. But you're exactly correct. You anticipate that, I'm going to emphasize universal basic income because if you have it, for two reasons. One, let me start with the politics of it. It has tremendous momentum from conservative and liberal. So the conservative side, National Review magazine, have, I won't say endorsed it, but they certainly have written about it and thought about it and taken it serious. And then also folks like Charles Murray, the famous sociologist of the Bell Curve book, also has written a book on it, endorsing it for sure. Along with people like Andrew Yang, who has also written about it and ran a political campaign primarily based on universal basic income. So there's some momentum there. But secondly, it allows workers to pretend like, well, let me try that again. I was going to say pretend like they're wealthy, but let me not say pretend. It gives them literal wealth to take risks on themselves, like those of us that are wealthy, right? My kids don't have to work. My oldest does. My other two don't. They're a little bit young to be working, but I anticipate they may not work because they don't have to. And what do? Well, you know, they can, you know, go to college. You know, they can try some things out. Or if they get a job and they don't like it, you know, after they enter the labor force, they're going to have the luxury because they have a little wealth behind them to try out a different industry. And universal basic income allows everybody some degree of latitude to say, I don't like working retail, I'm going to go get trained in something else because I have this other money coming in. It's not very much. I have to have roommates. But that would be the idea for me, Lee. I think that would go a long, long way, and it would put a lot of pressure on a lot of businesses to have to pay the workers decent and treat them better than what a lot of American businesses do today.
And I think you had talked about that being $1,000 a month per person. Everybody would get it. Would that? Here's a couple questions off that, and then yeah. We're gonna. Unfortunately, the time is almost up. But just to get your answers on this. So you're talking about $1,000 a month. I'm assuming that's somewhere close to $1 trillion per year that would have to be budgeted for. I guess my question is, would that put an end to all other subsidies in your mind? In other words, would welfare disappear? Would food stamps disappear? And then on top of that, wouldn't you suspect that the price of goods and services would rise, you know, similar to what happened with education, where the government got involved, gave away education with really no cosigner, no necessary backing, and everything went through the roof.
So let me just a pet peeve of mine is the government getting involved caused the price of tuition goes. It's the banks that are involved.
Yeah. Okay.
The banks
fair enough.
Want
fair
to
enough.
Put
fair
people
enough.
In debt.
Right.
Now the government undoubtedly has endorsed that and allowed the banks to make money off of young people. But it's the banks that got involved that I think is the primary cause. And that's a big mess. I don't have any solution there. But and you using that as an analogy, would that happen? Would we get into another big mess along those lines? I don't think so. Where we see our inflation, you know, just yesterday the stock market hit an all-time record. Here's how it's working. Primarily, if you're wealthy, you do really well in this economy. You do tremendously well. And, you know, I'm in higher education. I'm not making a fortune, but, I'm not complaining either. I'm doing just fine. But, you know, I'm able to get into real estate. And so, you know, and that's where I take my wealth, and anything extra, I put it in there. So where we see the inflation, where we see the you know, whatever you want to call it, a bubble type of thing, is that money going to the very wealthy in this country, which is, again, about 14% of us. So stock market prices, real estate prices, things that we buy. Now, if you were to somehow reallocate that by the mechanism of universal income, would that lead to inflation? Well, we'd have to keep our eye on it is the short answer. But it would be in very particular goods. And I think for the most part, we wouldn't see very much. It wouldn't really show up at the macro level. But you might see, you know, maybe the price of cars, for example, because more people would be able to afford cars. So in some sectors, you might see prices swell. But I don't think we're talking about a large enough redistribution for that to really have a major effect. I think it would just give a little bit of security without really any major sort of bubble in any sector, and I would say zero at the macro level.
All right. Listen, I would I'm sorry.
No, in my opinion, yeah. And I just wanted to say, you know, those are, you know, you're exactly right. That's, you know, we'd want to debate that and you know, set things up to address it policy-wise if we put universal income in place and start to play with it.
Well, we need some kind of answer, man. I don't know if it's universal income, but I do know that, you know, the younger generation, what's the incentive for them to go out and work if they know they can't own a house, if they know it's almost impossible, if, you know, if in fact they are working 40 hours, making, you know, taking home $500, it's hard, man. I don't know.
You know,
in
higher education, you know, the average income has gone down 2%, you know, in the last 30 years with a college degree. But what I always say is you know, you have to differentiate that, because you know, you could just, you know, the richest 50%, the poorest 50% that graduate from college, you'll see the richest 50% have gone up. But for a lot of college graduates, they've gone down. For high school graduates, if that's where you stopped, it's gone down 26% in the last 30 years, 26% decrease in real wages. So that's where, you know, we need something to address that shrinkage.
Yeah.
And part of it is the lack of laws, but the other part of it is technology. Technology is just replacing people, and that pushes the price down. So you need some sort of response to that.
His name is Hans Despen. Yeah, no, listen, I got to go, kid, but I appreciate it very much.
Yeah.
You coming on, as always. You're great, man. And
thanks, Lee.
All right, buddy.
It's always great to talk to you.
You got it. Listen, Hans Despen, economics chair up at Nichols. And we got to get him on a little bit more. It's been a couple of weeks, maybe even a month since we had him on last. So we'll grab him and get him on down the road for sure. We got to run. We'll be right back. Hang on.